So of those things that God said he hates right there, I mean, at least six of the seven of those. Would there be any pride involved to do what was there? I mean, we can make a strong case that it was seven for seven of those things that the Lord hates and say that are, and says that are abomination to him, that those were all involved there in that matter. So this was a very abominable action that was taken that cost Naboth his life, such that Ahab could take his vineyard that he coveted. And again, we noted the principle that for sin to occur, it begins with the evil desires, like coveting. And that's where it starts in the heart. That's where the battle has to be fought and won, so that we can take captive every thought to the obedience of Christ. When the thoughts are not taken captive, and then they conceive, it's going to bring forth sin, which will lead to death. We read that from James 1, 13 through 15 last week, which is why Jesus also taught in the Sermon on the Mount, and we looked at some examples there from Matthew 5. These actions that are evil start with thoughts, and that's where the battle has to be fought and won. So we can see where it started there with Ahab, with his desire, his coveting of that vineyard, and then all this evil was done to take it away. So in verse 15 in 1 Kings chapter 21, back to our study there, it says, "It came to pass when Jezebel heard that Naboth was stoned and was dead, that Jezebel said to Ahab, 'Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give thee for money, for Naboth is not alive but dead.'" Now notice in her report there, she's using that little barb. By the way, she's describing it there. Whose fault is it that he's dead? That the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give thee for money. So did he deserve to die because he was so uncooperative and refused to sell his property to him? I mean, you can see the rationalization, the justification there. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, Proverbs 21:2. Was this kind of wickedness able to be justified in the minds of the ones who were doing it? Was Jezebel able to... was she able to make her conscience not bother her in that? What conscience she may have possessed that wasn't already seared with a hot iron? But, she was able to say, look, he refused to sell the land, so she got it. Was she one that believed that the ends would justify the means? She obviously did. It didn't matter to her what it took. Whatever she desired to do, she would do it, and no matter the price. So she was willing to do anything. That's going to come up here in a few verses when the Lord brings his word and prophecies against them for this evil that was committed. So verse 16 says, "It came to pass when Ahab heard that Naboth was dead, that Ahab rose up to go down to the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite to take possession of it." And there's a period there, but that's not the end of this matter. We need to remember that too, because there are lots of things that happen in this world that are evil. And sometimes very powerful people like this, when they do evil things, might appear to get away with it. And we might not see that there are any ramifications or any punishment that comes for that. And that can be very discouraging to see when evil is done and the ones who are evildoers don't seem to be having to pay a price for the wickedness. And when that happens, and what can be the result there when people look and see wickedness that's not being punished? Is that going to perhaps cause some that they would be willing to do evil too, that there's not going to be any consequences? And that can encourage others to do evil. But we do need to always remember in everything that God is watching, and he is in control of everything, and God is going to bring all wickedness into judgment. Does it sometimes happen in this life that evildoers will suffer consequences of their actions in this life? Well, certainly so. The Lord in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 7, when he refers to the authorities, the earthly authorities, the governments, and the power that they have, and when he's telling us to submit to those authorities, and he says they don't bear the sword in vain. So when it comes to obeying the laws of the land, including paying our taxes and everything else, what happens when you don't follow the laws? Well, what happens to lawbreakers? Well, very often we see the as it's referred to, the long arm of the law catches up. And of course, this is the Lord ruling over man. Is this world, even though it seems very chaotic, there's lots of wickedness going on, but does the Lord still keep, does he keep order in this world? Well, he does, and that's something he tells us to pray for concerning the authorities, that in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verses 1 through 4, 1 Timothy chapter 2, 1 through 4, we need to pray for the authorities for our sakes, that we can live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty. Is it the Lord's desire that things would in this world would be at a point where the devil's able to run amok and do everything that he wants to do, and so that there's no order at all anywhere, and so that we wouldn't be able to live our lives in serving the Lord like he commands us to? Well, that's not the Lord's desire for things to be like that, and he is in control of things and asks us, commands us to ask him to enable us to live our lives in that way, that we can follow the Lord and serve him. But there are going to be times when wickedness is going to be very prevalent in the world, perilous times. We're warned about that. 2 Timothy chapter 3 says that there are going to be perilous, very dangerous times spiritually that will exist in this world. The whole world does lie in wickedness, 1 John 5:19. It always does, but there are times that are very perilous. This was one in Israel. This was a very low point in Israel's history, spiritually speaking, under Ahab, with Jezebel there with him. And we're told that he was more evil than any before or after him. So this was a low point. These were perilous times when things like this would happen. But even though this kind of evil was being done, where the top of the government, the king himself, could have his wife instruct somebody to go and falsely accuse an innocent man to have him killed so that his property could be taken away by the ruler, when that kind of thing is going on, is that good? Of course not. But this is not the end of the story. And so we are reminded of God, the one who has all authority and the one who is the judge of all things, that he is watching everything, and he will bring every deed into judgment. And many times, as we mentioned, there will be consequences in this life. Now, most importantly, there is going to be that day of judgment to come. There are things that happen in this life that are not punished, wickedness in this world. There are certain things that will go on, and the Lord may not have it dealt with here and now, but he is going to on the day of judgment. And so that is a fact. So nobody's ever going to get away with anything in that ultimate sense. But the Lord is also very willing to have punishments brought upon evildoers even in this life. And this was going to be the case here. So we want to turn now to 1 Kings 21 and start looking at verse 17. God is now going to speak on this matter. So who on this earth was able to take action and do something about the king here and his wife Jezebel? Well, nobody per se, but God was. So verse 17 says, "And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, So we were last looking at Elijah in the previous chapter at the well, really at the end of chapter 19, when Elijah was wishing himself to be dead, seeing no purpose for him to be around anymore, because he felt like he was the only one left in all Israel that was serving God, and God told him he still had 7,000 in Israel that had not bowed their knee to Baal, and God had work for him to do, as he told him he was going to be anointing a new king of Syria, he was going to be anointing a new king of Israel, and he was going to be anointing a replacement for his office at some point. So there were those works to do, and here we see that God still has use for Elijah, great use, work for him to do in service to him as his prophet. So he's not done with Elijah yet. He's not done with Israel yet. So now we see Elijah back in action as God is using him, sending him to Ahab to meet him. So the last time he saw Ahab, what was going on? That was after in chapter 18. When God sent the fire down from the sky and consumed the sacrifice that he had laid out on that altar that he had built and repaired, the one to Jehovah, there at Mount Carmel with all Israel there. And they saw that, and Baal's prophets had failed, and they're asking Baal to send fire down on their offering. And so all the people said, Jehovah, he is God. And they killed they were there assisting, or at least allowing Elijah to bring those false prophets of Baal to be put to death. And then the famine ended, and so that was the last time Elijah was with Ahab, and then he went and told Jezebel about the death of her prophets. So then Elijah was running for his life, and that's what led him down to the wilderness, where he felt like it was all over. Well, it's not. And so now God's inspiring him with these words, prophecy against Ahab and Jezebel for this evil that they've done. And so he sent him to meet Ahab. So is it safe for Elijah now to see Ahab again? Well, it is from the standpoint of God sending him to do it, God's going to protect him. He's not going to allow Ahab to do him harm, or Jezebel either. So another reminder there. So when God says to go meet Ahab in verse 18, does Elijah say, well, I can't. If I go to meet him, I'm going to die. No, God says, go meet Ahab. So he obeys. Does he have faith in God? Does he have faith such that he's going to obey even when he knows that his life could be in jeopardy for doing that? God told him to go, so he goes. So we see the great faith and the courage that Elijah has to obey his God. So God told him in verse 18, arise, go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, which is in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, whither he has gone down to possess it. So God knows exactly where Ahab is at this moment, and he wants and commands Elijah to go meet him there. And says in verse 19, and thou shalt speak unto him, saying, here's a prophecy. Here's what God says is going to happen to Ahab because of what had transpired for him to take this vineyard. Thus saith the Lord, hast thou killed and also taken possession? And thou shalt speak unto him, saying, thus saith the Lord, in the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick thy blood, even thine. So Elijah goes to him. Now, was it going to carry extra weight for Elijah to meet him in the very place, in that vineyard, to say, okay, here's what you've taken, and here's what God is going to do about it? God wanted that point to be made, and made right there. It was going to strengthen that. In verse 20, Ahab said to Elijah, hast thou found me, O mine enemy? Now, is Elijah Ahab's enemy? No. Who was Ahab's enemy? Ahab was Ahab's enemy. He was opposing himself. I mean, he doesn't understand what he's doing. You remember in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verses 20, we can go over there and read that, because this is exactly along the lines of what he's talking about here with what's going on with Ahab. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 24, he says, "And the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle unto all men, apt to teach, patient in meekness, instructing those that oppose themselves, if God peradventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth, and that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, who are taken captive by him at his will." So God's describing the condition of the world, and the world is in the devil's snare. But who are they? Who is their enemy? He says they're opposing themselves. Now, how many people recognize that that's exactly what's going on, that they are opposing themselves and that they're their own enemy? I mean, we all have the choice whether to glorify God as God. We know we have a creator. He's made that abundantly clear by the evidence of the creation. So we all know that we have a maker that we need to seek and serve. So nobody has an excuse, and that's all in Romans chapter 1, 18 through 21 and following, just as a refresher on that. But that's the fact. We all know we have a creator that we should be seeking and serving, and so we all have the choice to do that. And if we choose not to, and then God's anger is revealed against us, and we have that strong delusion and believe a lie, I mean, who is ultimately responsible for that condition that we're in? I mean, we are, because we made the choice not to glorify God as God. That's our choice. And if we choose to then turn away from that bad choice that we made to then seek the Lord, he's not far from any one of us. If we are beginning to feel after him, as Paul preached on Mars Hill in Acts 17, and if we draw near to God, he'll draw near to us. If we seek, we'll find. So that those opportunities are there. And God gives us all many by his goodness, his long-suffering, his love and grace and mercy. But there is a point where those opportunities are going to be exhausted, where God has given us everyone that that he's willing to give us. And if we continue to refuse and refuse all the way through that, then we're opposing ourselves. And so in the end, if that happens and we refuse all the way to our grave, then what's going to happen? Who's going to pay for it? If we choose not to serve God, who's going to pay for that choice in the end? Well, we will. I mean, we'll be spending our eternity separated from him in a lake of fire that burns with that fire and brimstone forever. I mean, that's where we'll be, and that will be the reason. And so who's going to be able to say on the day of judgment, well, it was this other person's fault that I didn't seek you or serve you? Somebody going to get a pass on judgment day with that excuse? Nobody has an excuse. So anybody that's doing evil, they're opposing themselves. We need to keep that in mind, because that can certainly change the way we approach people when we recognize that, which is why the Lord tells us that in those instructions in 2 Timothy chapter 2, that we shouldn't be going out to fight all these people, even when they are having the response to us like Ahab did to Elijah. I mean, Elijah was speaking God's word. That's all he was doing, telling him the truth. Galatians 4:16. The Apostle Paul asked this of his brethren in Galatia, ones that he had converted to Christ. And he said, "Am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth?" Well, what was the fact there? Well, they started listening to some other ones who were preaching another gospel. And they were listening to that. And so they were turning away from the truth to that falsehood. And as they were doing so, and then Paul was instructing them, correcting them for that, how did they respond? Did they thank Paul for speaking that truth to them? "Thank you, Paul, for being willing to tell me that truth, to call me to repentance, so that I won't lose my soul in the end. Thank you for that. Thank you for helping me so that I don't lose my soul." Is that how they responded? No. They turned against Paul. They were mad at him. They regarded Paul as the enemy then because he had told them the truth. If we see that and that happens to us, which it will, and sometimes it'll even be our brethren when they fall into sin, and they may respond in that negative way. Well, if we don't have a proper understanding of what's really going on there, we might get pretty frustrated and upset with other people. But the Lord reminds us, look, they're opposing themselves. I mean, they have a strong delusion here, and they're their own enemy. You remember in 1 Samuel chapter 8 when the people of Israel demanded a king, and Samuel was the judge. They didn't want to have a judge anymore. They wanted a king. And so Samuel felt the sting of that rejection as a rejection of himself. But what did God tell Samuel, the prophet? They rejected you. They rejected me, he said. So Samuel wasn't the enemy. He wasn't the problem. They were their own problem, but they were rejecting God. Well, Ahab, as he speaks these words, Elijah's not his enemy. He's his own enemy. And these things that he's doing, they're his fault. Elijah's role here is going to him with God's truth. If at any point along this way, Ahab had actually listened to what Elijah was saying, what God was saying through him, these aren't Elijah's words. And God has proven they're not Elijah's words. These are God's words. I mean, what could Ahab have done a couple chapters back, three chapters back in chapter 18, when God sent that fire down from heaven? Everybody else in Israel, they were gathered there at Mount Carmel on that occasion when Elijah said, "How long do you halt between two opinions? If Jehovah be God, serve him. If Baal be God, serve him." And they agreed to look at that situation, and when whoever bore witness by this miracle of sending the fire down on the sacrifice on an altar would obviously be the true God, and the prophet that was in his name would be in by the authority of the true God, as that testimony from God himself would be manifest by the miracle, which is what happened why the people said, "Jehovah, he is God," and why the false prophets of Baal, being exposed as such, were killed on that day. Well, Ahab was there. He saw the same thing. What could he have done that day? Could he have also said, "Jehovah, he is God," and recognized that fact, and then repented of his sins and turned to God and away from his evil ways? He could have done that. Did he have to have 3.5 years of famine? I mean, that was 3.5 years of Ahab's stubbornness. But he had searched for Elijah, wanted him put to death, blaming him for the famine. Well, the famine, and of course, Elijah pointed that out back in chapter 18. "I'm not the one that's troubled Israel. You have," Elijah told him, "because of all of his wickedness and that of Jezebel." That was the problem. They were the problem. It was not Elijah. So here we see those words again where Ahab has... is claiming that that Elijah is his enemy. So he says, "Have you found me, O mine enemy?" And he said, answered, "I have found thee because thou hast sold thyself to work evil in the sight of the Lord." So is Elijah reminding him of who the real problem is, who Ahab's real enemy is? He says, "You have sold yourself to work evil in the sight of the Lord." And that's why he's being sent now. So it's because of his own doings. Verse 21, "Behold, I will bring evil upon thee, and will take away thy posterity, and will cut off from Ahab him that pisseth against the wall, and him that is shut up and left in Israel, and will make thine house like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha the son of Ahijah, for the provocation wherewith thou hast provoked me to anger and made Israel to sin." So that's what he pronounces against Ahab, and for the reason, and gives the reason. So he was going to bring evil upon him. What was going to happen to Ahab and his family? His family was going to be wiped out. It was going to be wiped out with none remaining. What happened to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and his family, the first king of the divided kingdom of Israel? His family was wiped out by Baasha in fulfillment of God's prophecy because of the evil that Jeroboam had done. What had happened to the house of Baasha, the one that had destroyed all of Jeroboam's family? His family was destroyed because he followed after the same sins. So we already have had two examples of that, of the kings of Israel that preceded Omri and his son Ahab. But God tells him what happened to those two families is going to happen to you. So far with the kings of the divided kingdom of Israel, how many have passed from father to son? Well, with those two families, and now this third one with Omri and Ahab, and Ahab is going to have two sons that will briefly reign, but that's it. So his family was going to come to an end just like Jeroboam's and Baasha's for the same reason. Because they were wicked is why God brought that destruction on the houses of Jeroboam and Baasha. And he said it was going to happen to Ahab, to his family, for the provocation wherewith thou hast provoked me to anger and made Israel to sin. So was it only this situation with Naboth's vineyard? This is really the last straw, as it were. But there had been many, many straws before that on that camel's back. How many things had Ahab done that were wicked up to this point? And he's pointing that out. It was not just, and his personal wickedness was vast, great, exceeded all others before him in Israel, as we were told at the end of chapter 16 of 1 Kings. But not only that, how much sin had he caused God's people to fall into because of his wickedness? Well, he married Jezebel, and then Baal worship was brought into Israel. And how many people had turned away from God to Baal because of them? Well, God said there were 7,000 in Israel that hadn't bowed their knee to Baal, but that was it. Everybody else had bowed their knee to Baal. And who was responsible for so many Israelite knees bowing to Baal in this time? Ahab and Jezebel, and was God going to let that go unpunished? He was not going to let any of this wickedness go unpunished. Now, this has been going on for years, and on the surface it may have looked like all the way through here. Look at all the way, if someone had been a righteous one in Israel seeing all of this, would they have been thinking, look at the evil this king is doing, and this wife that he married, and all of the evil she's doing, and nobody can say anything about it. Nobody can do anything about it. And it's been going on for years. I mean, it would have been very discouraging to see all of that, which is why what happened with those who were righteous. Many of them had left Israel and gone to Judah. But the ones that hadn't, if they were there in Israel, they weren't bowing their knees. But were they able to stand up and say and do anything about this? No. But if they had been thinking those thoughts, as it would be easy to do under those circumstances, we can see here that God is not going to let this go. And so he is going to bring an end to Ahab and his family and Jezebel for all of this evil. So what he pronounces there against Ahab, it was destruction of it. There are several things that are included in this prophecy. In verse 19, in the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, will dogs lick your blood, even yours? Well, we read about the stoning of Naboth and how he died a few verses up. Did it mention what happened to his blood after he was, I mean, he was stoned. What happens when someone is stoned? I mean, they are pelted with rocks until, I mean, the trauma it becomes so great, they die from it. Well, that sheds blood. I mean, that it's graphic, yes, but that was a very evil thing they did. His blood was shed, and it flowed out and was on the ground. And then what happened? There were dogs that came and licked that blood up. We weren't told about that before, but we know it happened, and they licked that blood up in this particular spot. But God knew where that spot was, and he knew what happened, and he was going to bring his vengeance on Ahab. And he says, your blood is going to get licked up by dogs in the same place that Naboth's blood got licked up by dogs. So was that going to be a worthy punishment to Ahab for what he had done. And we can see that God was, he didn't say, well, I you didn't actually write the letters. Jezebel wrote them, and she's the one that came up with the plan, devised that by that wicked imagination against Naboth, so I'll get her for that, but you're going to get off on that from that one. No, God did not look at it that way at all. He knew that Ahab was responsible for what his wife did. He was the king, and he was holding him accountable for that evil that was done to Naboth, and his blood was going to be licked up in the very same place. Now, we remember at the end of chapter 20 when that prophet had spoken about Ahab, that he was going to, his life was going to be required for letting Ben-Hadad, the Syrian king, go. And his life would go for his, and his people for the Syrian people. So Ahab was going to actually receive his fatal wound in battle against the Syrians. So that was going to, and that's the next chapter when that happens in 1 Kings 22. That's what we get to read next, Lord willing. But that was going to fulfill that prophecy too that had already been made by another prophet. But even though he was going to be wounded, receive a mortal wound there in Ramoth and Gilead, and he was going to die, they were going to bring his chariot back and that he had bled profusely in, and they were going to wash that chariot out, and his blood flowed out of that chariot on the ground in that same spot where Naboth's blood had been licked up. And that prophecy was fulfilled exactly like God said. In fact, we're going to go ahead and take a peek ahead just to see the fulfillment of it. It's in 1 Kings chapter 22, the next chapter, verses 37 and 38, it says, "So the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria, and one washed the chariot in the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood, and they washed his armor, according to the word of the Lord which he spake." So that was fulfilled exactly like God said, so that was part of it. He was going to be wounded and die from wounds in battle against the Syrians to fulfill one prophecy, but the blood was going to end up being licked up in that same place where Naboth had been. That was also fulfilled. And he was going to have his entire family destroyed. That was going to come later, but that was also a prophecy that was fulfilled. What he said in verse 22, his house being made like that, the house of Jeroboam and the house of Baasha. And peeking ahead on that one to 2 Kings chapter 9, if we can turn over there for a moment and read verses 7 through 10. 2 Kings chapter 9, verses 7 through 10. It says, "And thou shalt smite the house of Ahab thy master." These were the instructions given by Elijah when he was sent to anoint Jehu the son of Nimshi to be the next king of Israel. Which you remember back in chapter 19, God told him he was going to anoint Jehu to be the next king of Israel. Well, after Ahab's two sons, but he would be, Jehu would be the one to bring that judgment on the house of Ahab, to kill all of his family. And so he was, at this time Elijah came to him and told him, "Thou shalt smite the house of Ahab thy master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish. And I will cut off from Ahab him that pisseth against the wall, and him that is shut up and left in Israel. And I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha the son of Ahijah. And the dog shall eat Jezebel in the portion of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her." And he opened the door and fled. So this was, the time at Elisha carrying forth instructions there with those words to Jehu on this occasion. But this was going to happen, and it did. And Jehu carried that out and destroyed, and that's what we have to look forward to in our study. And we get to 2 Kings and see all the details there. But he killed all of what remained. Ahab was dead at this point, and one of his sons, Ahaziah. But Jehu was going to kill the remaining son who was king, Jehoram, Ahab's son. And then he killed all the others of Ahab's 70 sons and fulfilled God's prophecy that all the house of Ahab would be destroyed for this evil. And God was taking a vengeance for the blood that had been shed by Ahab and through Jezebel, of particularly of God's servants, and the prophets and his other servants. Well, Naboth was one of those servants of his, but there were many righteous ones who were killed by those wicked, that wicked king and queen. And so God was going to bring that judgment upon them. Well, back in chapter 21, there he had words for Jezebel that we just saw mentioned in chapter 9 there. What he said was going to happen, what Jehu was going to carry out against Jezebel. But that was first prophesied back here in 1 Kings 21 in verse 23. And let's read 23 and 24. It says, "And of Jezebel also spake the Lord, saying, the dogs shall eat Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel. Him that dieth of Ahab in the city, the dog shall eat, and him that dieth in the field shall the fowls of the air eat." So he was going to bring judgment on Jezebel for all the evil that she did. And Jehu was the one to do that. I'll give you the reference in 2 Kings 9, 30 through 37, when that happened. But what God prophesied against Jezebel, it happened. And so she was also killed, and then she was eaten by dogs, not just have her blood licked up, but actually eaten by dogs. And there was just a little bit of scraps left of her, as the Lord said, so that no one would be able to say, well, there's Jezebel. There wouldn't be enough left to be able to point and identify and say that's her. The dogs ate her. So this was a great curse that God brought upon that wicked woman for all the evil that she did. But all of Ahab's family were going to be destroyed for all of this. So in verse 25, or 25 and 26, it describes, summarizes all of the evil that has been done, that was done by Ahab. "But there was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up. And he did very abominably in following idols according to all things, as did the Amorites, whom the Lord cast out before the children of Israel." None like Ahab, he says. There was none that had reached these points. He sold himself. And that's what happened. Again, whose enemy, if somebody's not doing the Lord's will, whose enemy are they? They're their own enemy. And he sold himself to work wickedness. Jesus asked the question, "What shall a man give in exchange for his soul?" And when we choose wickedness, we're selling our souls for some price. And that's what's happening, whether somebody realizes it or not. That's what it means to be one's own enemy. You're putting a price on your own soul to say, okay, I'm willing to lose my soul for eternity for this, whatever it is. Well, Ahab sold himself to do wickedly. He was willing to give up his soul for what? Well, for whatever he wanted as king, including this vineyard. I'm sure it was a very nice vineyard. And he maybe got to go and enjoy that vineyard for a bit. Maybe had some nice grapes he got out of it. But was that vineyard, is there any vineyard that's so nice it's worth losing your soul for eternity for? And not just a vineyard, but anything. What if one were to gain the whole world? I mean, is this whole world worth our soul? There's nothing that's worth that price. But Ahab sold himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel, his wife, stirred up. She was encouraging evil. We remember the Lord's commandment in Hebrews chapter 10 and verses 23 and 24. It's the reason, a major part of the reason why we assemble together, to provoke each other to love and to good works. Now, we're going to have effect on other people one way or another. We can either be stirring others up to do good, and we can be known by the Lord and others for that we can be somebody that provokes others to love and to good works, stirring people up to do righteously, or we can be somebody that encourages evil and stirs people up to do evil. That's what Jezebel did. And Ahab, Did he have responsibility for allowing himself to be stirred up to do evil? Yes, that's what God was saying there. Now, did Jezebel also have responsibility for being willing to stir somebody up to do evil? Yes, and that's why God pronounced his punishment on her. But we can look at that and think about ourselves and what kind of effect we want to have on people in our lives. And may we choose to be those who stir people up to do righteously, to provoke others to love and to good works, and never to evil. We're out of time for this morning. Lord willing, we'll continue there finish up the last little bit of our study of 1 Kings 21. And then we have 1 Kings 22, which will enable us, by the way, to then get back into some 2 Chronicles, which we've departed for a while. But 2 Chronicles 18 parallels 1 Kings 22. So we're getting very close to being able to look at those two books together again. So Lord willing, we will get to that point next Lord's Day, at least a little bit, if he is willing. We do appreciate everybody being here this morning and taking part in the study, whatever way that you have been. And please join us again next time for that. We'll close our time of study at this time. Brother Peter, would you lead us in prayer, please?